morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. In just a little while, we're going to be talking about the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival, and we're going to be speaking to a theoretical biologist about HIV virus and possible vaccines for that. Right now, I would like to welcome Susan Turetsky. She is the executive director of the New Mexico Landlord-Tenant Hotline. Welcome.
Well, good afternoon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to have you.
I've been up a long time.
It's been a while since you were here. And the landlord, first of all, tell us about the Landlord-Tenant Hotline.
The Landlord-Tenant Hotline is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we are here to help both landlords and tenants resolve their conflicts, give them information about their rights, their obligations, and their responsibilities under the landlord-tenant law.
And so that's a job in which you, interestingly enough, take both positions. You have to remain quite neutral and advocate for both sides.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, many times people will call in, a tenant will call in and say, oh, my crazy landlord. And I'll say, you know, I'm not going to take that ride with you. We're going to talk only about the facts, because in 5 minutes, that crazy landlord's going to call me up and talk about that wacky tenant.
And that happens to you.
All the time.
And so you give courses for landlords and tenants.
Yes, I have approximately 6 workshops annually for landlords. I have 2 workshops for licensed realtors, property managers, brokers. I have 2 workshops for tenants. We have coffees so that tenants can understand what their rights and obligations and remedies are also.
And I guess you cover the whole state of New Mexico. People all over the state are having one kind of problem or another. What are some of the common problems that people call you with?
The most common problems are that the tenant isn't paying the rent, and the landlord wants to know if they can lock them out, if they can shut off the lights, slam the door, whatever it is. And, of course, that's illegal. And if the landlord does lock the tenant out of the property, blocks their access to the property, disconnects any normal necessary utilities to the property, the tenant can sue the landlord for 2 times the monthly rent. Another problem is that the tenant will call and say, I left there 45 days ago and I haven't heard one thing, and I left my landlord a $900 security deposit and I haven't heard a thing. How do I get my deposit back? And there are laws.
And there are laws. Do they vary from city to city, county to county across the state of New Mexico?
That's a good question. No. Landlord-tenant laws are state laws. They vary from state to state, but it's all the same throughout the state of New Mexico. There are 52 statutes that govern landlords and tenants in New Mexico, and our set of laws is called the Uniform Owner-Resident Relations Act.
And how old is that?
Oh, I think it's been modified. I think it's from 1976.
And so this is something that you have probably memorized all 52 pieces of.
Yeah, I'm pretty good at it.
So you've got an event coming up on Tuesday, the 2nd of December, Landlord Tenants Rights, Obligations, and Remedies.
This workshop is designed for licensed realtors, property managers, brokers. I am licensed to teach for 5 continuing credit hours. So for anybody who is licensed, who wants to get continuing credit hours, all they have to do is call the Landlord-Tenant Hotline, sign up for the workshop, and we are providing lunch with that workshop. It's a 5-hour workshop, and we're going to go through everything.
It's from 9 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon, and you can get some credit hours from the, New Mexico Real Estate Commission?
Exactly.
And so you'll be covering all sorts of things. Anything else you want people to know about it?
Well, no. You know, it's coming up. Thanksgiving is coming up. And I want to say that, you know, I've been with the hotline now for 13 years. This is my 13th year on the phone. And I want to thank the city mayor, the counselors for supporting this project. And I also want to thank Los Alamos National Bank, because our building that I'm in on Alta Vista is undergoing tremendous renovation, and Los Alamos National Bank has offered us this community resource room to use with no charge.
Oh, that's very nice.
Very nice. Very nice.
So you're able to take the gazillions of irate and wild calls that come in all the time.
Well, I can take the calls at my office, but as far as having workshops is concerned,
right,
this is, you know, posed a little problem now under the renovation.
Susan Turetsky is Executive Director of the New Mexico Landlord-Tenant Hotline. And if you want to reach them, it's 983-8447. And you can also email them, probably even better, at nmhotline@aol.com. And once again, the upcoming workshop, Landlord Tenants' Rights and Obligations, is on December 2nd, which is a Tuesday from 9 to 2 in the afternoon.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Susan. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Duncan North. He is the creative director of Wild Earth Guardians and is here to talk to us about an upcoming event, which is the presentation of the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival this coming Thursday, November 20th, from 7 to 9 at the Armory for the Arts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So what kind of films are in this film festival?
These are films made by amateur filmmakers who are concerned about the environment. And they are short films ranging from 3 minutes to 25, 30 minutes.
So amateur filmmakers are making, would you call, passable or more than passable environmental films these days?
Well, you know, that depends on your frame of reference. I think it's interesting that in the last few years, the global conversation has expanded to include amateur filmmakers because of the advancements in digital technology. You can make a very gorgeous, sumptuous film with a $1,500 camera, whereas 20 years ago it would have required a $50,000 camera. So there really are some beautiful films in the festival, and some of them are allegorical and others are more documentary style. But it's very interesting, and it's
and one has swimming dogs in it, I just have to say
one
that.
One has swimming dogs in it, yes. Everybody loves a wet dog, except the people who have
especially,
to smell it.
Especially on film, rather than on your lap.
Precisely.
But there's films, for example, one about two young dudes who basically got a vegetable oil-powered Toyota and drove it from Alaska to Chile to both kayak and demonstrate that vegetable oil-powered vehicles actually function.
Yes, that was perhaps my favorite film. They got a car that was a Japanese fire truck and converted it to run on biofuels. And wherever they are, they use the local biofuel with palm oil in one part of Central America. And
they used fish oil somewhere?
Fish oils. They started with salmon oil because
right.
They were started in the northernmost part of Alaska. And it's interesting, you know, the environmental movement represents many, many different types of individuals. And these guys are clearly passionate about the earth and passionate about kayaking, and it's not clear which they're more passionate about. But it's great that you can, you know, kayak up and down North and South America and make a movie about it and have it be pro-environment. It's simultaneously uplifting and hilarious.
And as are several of the movies in the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival. So where is the environmental movement at right now? As you say, it's more than one thing. It's a lot of different movements.
Yeah, it ranges. It's, you know, everybody has their different environmental issues. At Wild Earth Guardians, we're concerned about wild rivers and wild streams, wildlands, forests, wildlife, we're concerned about animals, we're concerned about climate change. Most environmental groups pick one of those issues to focus on. Obviously, climate change is getting the most publicity right now, and that is appropriate. It's interesting to me that both presidential candidates made climate change a premier part of their campaigns.
It is the sort of domino that knocks all the other dominoes down in the sort of ecosystem question of what is getting damaged.
It is. Though there's vigorous debate at Wild Earth Guardians about, you know, the importance of wildlife as well, and there will always be a very strong wildlife contingent among environmentalists, and of course your tree hugger, who loves trees and.
Right, but all of these things are affected by climate change, so.
There are climate change. I will have to concede that it is the overarching umbrella, because if we lose that battle, all the other battles are lost.
And so When you have Wild Earth Guardians, which is one of many environmental organizations in the West, in New Mexico, in the United States, how do they communicate? How do they work together and have the kind of synergies that make political change possible?
How do we work with other groups?
Yeah.
Well, mostly we like to... No, I was going to make a joke. I won't make a joke about wrestling for funds. I know we've worked with NIMWA on wolves. You know, it depends.
NIMWA?
The New Mexico Wilderness Association.
Oh, right.
And it depends when your interests intersect with another environmental group. I think there could be better coordination among groups, but I think there could be better coordination among nonprofits nationwide. My brother works for a coffee company that does free trade coffee, and I think that human-oriented nonprofits and environmentally-oriented nonprofits all should get together. As you and I discussed before, there should be sort of a broad spectrum so that you can address all of your issues at once. But I'm avoiding your question because I don't really know the answer about how we coordinate with other groups. I'm assuming it's through telephone and carrier pigeon.
We're talking to Duncan North of Wild Earth Guardians. Well, it does bring up a kind of philosophical question, which is something that I've been wanting to talk to you and others about, which is the purpose of the environmental movement to save creatures and save ecosystems for their own sake or for our sake as human beings?
That is a very, very good question. And
I can only ask that to another St. John's person. No, that's not true.
Well, I'll give you a St. John's answer. As Nietzsche said, we all create our reality. There's always interpretations. And we don't, or to quote Schopenhauer, we don't want a thing because we found good reasons for it. We find good reasons for the things we want. Clearly, there are many environmentalists who are motivated by the urgency and the pressing needs of environmental issues. And there's one woman who works at, well, everyone who works at Wild Earth Guardians feels this way, but one in particular is passionately devoted to saving our wildlife. And others, I think, do it because they didn't get to sit at the popular table in high school. That's why I'm an environmentalist, is because I couldn't find friends, and they took me in and gave me shelter. But it depends. It varies from every environmentalist. Do you know what I mean? It's like, why does somebody go into acting? Some of them do it for attention. Others do it for the great paycheck. And others do it because they enjoy waiting on tables. There's not one answer that covers.
Yeah, I mean, I think though it's an interesting question to contemplate because, you know, does every species have a right to exist for its own sake? Which I think bothers a lot of people who feel that the human need to use resources and to use them carefully and for our own benefit and for our economic benefit really outweighs the right of some little spider species or whatever to have a habitat. And well, then on the other hand, you can make the argument, and many people do, that when you start messing with ecosystems, human life eventually gets really compromised and endangered itself.
Well, there is that whole web of life theory that if you start pulling out pieces of an engine, then eventually the engine breaks down and we all suffer. There's two different religious perspectives. You know, in Genesis, God gives man dominion over the animals, but in Noah Ark story, we're supposed to be custodians of the earth and the animals. I tend to think of humans as animals as well, and I see us as part of it.
I can see the argument for that.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's difficult to say. I'm certainly not the one to answer the question. I would say that everything should exist for him or herself, whether it's a person or an animal or anything on the planet, with the exception of a Dallas Cowboy fan, should exist for themselves.
Dallas Cowboy?
Sorry, I'm still upset about 2 days ago. Never mind.
We're talking to Duncan North of Wild Earth Guardians. So what is Wild Earth Guardians working on right now? What are their areas of focus?
Well, there's the government gave permission to this coal mine in the Rocky Mountain National Forest to expand, which would emit 12 million tons of methane into the air on a regular basis. And we're fighting that. We're also trying to protect the sage grouse. We're working to protect wolves down in southern New Mexico who are being hunted and trapped. We're doing something and everything. We're doing a program that it's called Outstanding National Resource Waters. There's a small provision in the Clean Water Act that provides for the indefinite protection of our cleanest waters and the surrounding watershed. So we're trying to protect 5,000 miles of river in New Mexico, which would equal several million acres of forest through this provision of the Clean Water Act. So we're trying to do many things, and I believe in it.
5,000 miles of river.
5,000 miles of river we want to have designated as outstanding national resource waters. And by doing that, it would protect those rivers in perpetuity as well as the surrounding watershed. So it's actually a really terrific thing, and it's a loophole that I think the government didn't realize people could use, but that's what we do at Wild Earth Guardians. We try to find creative solutions for problems, and you can find us at wildearthguardians.org and
send us
some money and help protect thousands of miles of river and millions of acres of pristine forest.
So when you protect thousands of miles of river, it protects millions of acres. How does one translate into the other?
Well, because there's all the feeders to a particular river. Let's say you have a river, we'll call it River X, and it's fed by streams and creeks that can stretch out for 30, 40 miles and around it.
So when a river is protected, all the creeks feeding it get protected as
Precisely.
Well?
Precisely. All of the tributaries get protected. It's called the watershed. And by protecting the watershed that feeds the rivers, because if you think about it, it would be meaningless to protect a river without protecting the surrounding watershed. It would be like protecting your torso without protecting your legs. You sort of need them to get your torso around. That's a terrible metaphor. Let's just move on. But yes, by protecting a mile of river, you could protect a lot of forest as well. And
so you are the creative director of Wild Earth Guardians. What do you do? What's your job over there, and how is Wild Earth Guardians communicating through you and through its other means?
Well, we're making cartoons. We made a cartoon about the Outstanding National Resource Water Campaign with fish with big lips.
So this was, I actually saw this at an event that you guys sponsored. These very, very lovely young animators from a university in southern New Mexico did this animation as a way of helping you communicate what the issues are to the public.
They did. So these great guys from New Mexico State University, the Creative Media Institute, made this cartoon for us. And we're trying to loosen up. You know, as you told me before, there's not a lot of humor in the environmentalist movement.
What's up with that?
I don't know what it is. Again, I think it gets back to high school. I think high school is when our humor foundation is built. And really, a team of psychiatrists would have to be employed to tell us what happened to the sense of humor. But I think when you lose the comedy advantage, you lose on issues. When I think of the 70s, I think about all those irreverent National Lampoon campaigns and movies.
All the Abbie Hoffmans of the world who were taking political issues and laughing at the same time.
Yeah, and I think that the left has gotten just more uptight. I would blame...
Super earnest is another way of thinking about it.
Yeah, super earnest. And political correctness is the enemy of comedy. And I think when people started to get concerned about what you say and how you say it, and I'm not going to blame feminists, because if I did, people would get mad at me. But definitely...
How many radical feminist environmentalist vegans does it take to screw in a light bulb?
I don't know. How
That's
many?
Not funny.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
That was great. I wish I had said that. I've got nothing now. You've totally taken my...
The Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival is happening this Thursday, November 20th from 7 to 9 at the Armory for the Arts. For tickets, you can call the Lenzing box office at 988-1234. Duncan North is the creative director of Wild Earth Guardians. Any else you want to let people know before we go?
I just want to remind them that our website is wildearthguardians.org. And
the phone number over there is 988-9126.
Yes, and I'd just like to ask everybody to help us, help you, help the planet.
There we have it. Duncan North, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Rui Ribeiro. He is a scientist with the Theoretical Biology and Biophysics Group at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and he will be speaking about HIV vaccines tonight at 7 o'clock at Santa Fe Complex at 624 Aguas Fria here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, good morning. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Good morning. So HIV, human immunodeficiency virus. I think everybody's heard of it. It's the virus that causes AIDS.
Right.
But here's a question which probably most of us don't know the answer to, namely, what is a virus?
Yeah, virus is a very small form of life, some would say, but that actually they only contain the information to make copies of itself, but they cannot do that by themselves. They have to always infect a cell. There are viruses of plants, there are viruses of humans, there are viruses of all types of animals, there are even viruses of bacteria. And what they do is they infect these cells, and then they use the machinery of the cell that usually serves normal function in the organism to make more copies of itself, and then they just come out of the cell, go on to infect other cells, and they propagate like that inside the organism.
So they're, I guess I've read that they're sort of a borderline form of life,
yeah,
because they are not themselves cells. They need cells in order to live, but they reproduce and replicate themselves as living beings do.
Yes, you're absolutely right. In the traditional concept, you wouldn't probably call it life because, as you mentioned, they cannot replicate by themselves. They always need to infect some cells of some organism, like the case of HIV.
Now, what do we know about how viruses evolved in the first place?
Wow, this is a very, very interesting question. Some people would say, and this is really not my area of expertise in general, how all types of viruses evolve. There's two ways to think about this. One is, where do they come from, you know, as a group? And that, there's a lot of controversy. We don't know exactly. You know, it could be that initially these genetic material that viruses have replicated more or less by itself, just what we'd call in solution, like by chemistry. And then they acquired what we call an envelope, and they become like self-organized, you know, minuscule entities. And then there's a big diversity of viruses that infect all types of organisms, as I mentioned. Then we can think about how the viruses evolve nowadays. Viruses are always changing, or almost all viruses are always changing, always acquiring mutations in their genetic material, which might then make new functions. For instance, HIV can escape treatment, for instance, when a person is treated, or might escape the immune response. And that is true also, for instance, say, influenza, the virus that's responsible for flu, which changes also by mutation. It's always changing. That's why we need to have a flu shot every year, a different one.
And so are viruses always harmful? You think of smallpox, or you
right.
think of HIV or the flu.
Right. No, it's, again, depends how you define harmful. In principle, they're not always harmful. Many of us are infected with many different viruses, of which we don't really, in most cases, have any symptoms or any clinical outcome. One typical one is what we call mononucleosis virus, also called the kissing disease, which is very common in the population. Maybe 90% of people are infected.
Is that
and,
right?
Yes.
And some people get symptoms and some don't?
Yeah. Some people get symptoms the first time a person gets infected for some period of time, and then you just are infected for life and do not have symptoms again, unless in specific cases, like for instance, if you're immunodeficient or are sick some other way. And that's true of many different types of virus. And then viruses tend to be very specific in the type of cells that they can infect. So a virus of a plant, for instance, wouldn't infect a person, in principle, and so those would be harmless as well. But in some sense...
And a virus that affects a cat might not infect a mouse.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And, you know, virus that infects different animals are very specific. But on the other hand, viruses always use some resources because they have to use the cell machinery and energy, let's say, to replicate. So there is that trade-off.
But what are they made of?
So they're made of, you know, typically proteins and lipids and things like that. So they have molecules. Typical virus could have the genetic material, which is RNA molecule or a DNA molecule inside. And then they have what's called the core, which is just a ball, let's say a sphere of proteins that encloses this genetic material as a protection. And then an envelope, which again is another sphere. It doesn't have to be spherical, by the way, but another outside coat of protein that again protects the virus and interacts with the cells that infect. So it's made of molecules, specific molecules, and
so proteins and lipids
that are either holding it together or
are actually genetic
sugars,
material.
Yes, exactly.
And so how do they make their way into a cell?
So most viruses will interact with some proteins, some receptors on the surface of cells that usually have a function, serve a function in the organism, and use that interaction to attach the cell to a cell and then go inside the cell. And you know, some viruses we don't know exactly how this happens. For instance, for hepatitis C virus, we don't know how it attaches to cells. What is the receptor that it uses on the surface of cells? But for HIV, we do know a lot how it interacts with cells and how it gets inside the cell.
Does it go inside of the nucleus of the cell?
Again, some viruses do and some don't. For instance, HIV does go eventually inside the nucleus of the cell. It even integrates its own genetic material into the genetic material of the cell, whereas hepatitis C virus does not go into the nucleus of the cell. But flu virus also goes into the nucleus of the cell, but does not integrate into the genetic material. So there's many different strategies that viruses have evolved to maintain their program and their progeny.
We're talking to Ruiz Ribeiro. He is going to be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Santa Fe Complex. So what are some of the ways that the human body or any body fights off viruses?
You know, we have the immune system, which is a very small name for a very big part of the organism. And the immune system is constituted by many different types of cells and molecules that have the function of fighting off foreign invaders, let's say. And they could be virus or bacteria or even toxins, allergens, so things that provoke allergy. So when we have an allergic reaction to peanuts or to bees, stings or something like that, it's the immune system reacting to that because it's a foreign body in the organism and it doesn't recognize and tries to attack it. You know, in a very brief way, we can, and immunologists, people who study the immune system, have divided it part which is called the innate immune system, which are that it's oldest in terms of evolution, and that it is the first line of defense against foreign invaders, pathogens like microbes and things like that. And there's many different cells that belong to that, and that's non-specific. That is, it fights the same type of cells would fight all kinds of, whether it's a bacteria or a virus or a toxin. And then there's what we call the adaptive immune system. That's a specific part, and that's what, for instance, antibodies that maybe people have heard about already are considered part of the adaptive immune system. And the antibodies are very small molecules made by some cells in our organism, B cells, which are in our blood. Some of these white, when you see the
B
white
cells,
B cells, because they are actually made in the bone marrow, and then they go into circulation. And so, those cells are part of the white blood cell count. That sometimes when you go to the doctor and you have a
elevated white blood cell count.
Yeah, for instance, it could be you have many B cells, although there's other cells that are also in this white blood cell count. Anyway, they make these antibodies, and antibodies could, for instance, coat a virus and prevent the virus from entering into the cell. Or they could.
So these are before the viruses enter into the cells.
Yes.
These little protein lipid things are swimming around.
Yes.
Your B cells are swimming around saying, oh, look at one of those. Let's go coat it.
It's something like that. And I think you describe it very well.
And so then once they coat it, they say, okay, now let's go into your liver and go away?
For instance, yes. There's different ways. They could coat it and then just be filtered out. Or they could signal other cells to come and actually eat these coated virus or coated bacteria. You know, it's actually the word that's used for it from the Greek phagocytosis, means to eat these coated foreign microbes. But you're absolutely right. This actually works before the virus or are inside the cell. And then there's another part of the immune system that has evolved to cope with those virus or those bugs that are inside cells. And once a virus, for instance, inside a cell, the cell will chop up bits of the virus, like it does chop up bits of itself as well all the time, and presents on its surface. It has like a little, you can think like a little handle that sticks out of the cell and shows to the immune system what's inside it. And then
so it's like, here's our trash.
Yeah.
Take it away.
Well, no, it's more like, this is what it's in here, inside. And it could be that most times when we are healthy, it just bits that are normal for the function of the organism, and then the immune system doesn't act when it sees that. It recognizes it's what we call self. Itself. So
okay, so it says you're doing fine.
Yeah, you're doing
fine. We're just going to go on.
Yeah. When it's something that it's non-self, so it's unusual to be there, then it triggers the immune system and other cells of the immune system to respond and kill the infected cell, the cell that has this virus inside it. And so these are, you know, in very broad terms, the way that the immune system...
But so the immune system will go to a cell that has a virus in it or has some kind of infection and say, very bad, we're going to kill the whole thing.
Yes.
How does it do that? Eats it up? Coats it?
There's many different ways. I mean, there are some cells that have very nasty chemicals inside, and they would just release that very close to these infected cells, and those chemicals will, say, poke holes in the cell membrane, the one that's infected, and thus the cell will die. Others.
This is very sophisticated.
Yes, it's very sophisticated, the way that it all works. And it all works, in some ways, you know, almost without you noticing it, without us noticing it. I mean, although often when we have fever or when we feel icky from an infection, that's because the immune system is reacting and it's doing its job.
Well, heating the body to 103 or whatever temperature is one of the ways that it kills.
Yes, I mean, it is. That is one way to demonstrates the activation of the immune system. And there's a whole cascade of different molecules that can be released that will help activate the right cells, will help the cells have this function of killing other cells. So the whole thing is highly coordinated, even though we can talk about one cell type or a few molecules or something. There's really, and it's very redundant as far as we can tell. So there is lots of mechanisms and lots of participants in these mechanisms that coordinate to most often clear an infection in a way that's transparent to us, let's say. But in many ways, you can also think of, you know, many other barriers as part of, you know, passive parts of the immune system, like our skin or our eyes, tears, and so forth. I mean, all this exists to prevent a foreign body to get into the organism in the first place. So the immune response is like the last line of defense, hopefully.
We're talking to Rui Ribeiro. He is in the Theoretical Biology and Biophysics Group at Los Alamos National Laboratories. He will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Santa Fe Complex about HIV vaccine. So let's talk about HIV. HIV is a special kind of virus, a retrovirus.
Yes.
What's the difference between a virus and a retrovirus?
Well, a retrovirus is a type of virus that has... typically, it has the genetic information coded in a molecule of RNA. And I'll try to explain a little bit about this. And then it will transcribe this RNA into DNA. So in the genetic material now is in the DNA molecule. And that's the same type of molecule, DNA, that stores the information of humans or mammals or things like that.
Or any living organism that has cells.
Yes. Exactly. Any living bacteria, so forth, have DNA as well.
Worms, plants, you know.
Yeah,
corn.
Worms, plants, corn, yeah. Okay. all that. You're absolutely right. And so typically, this genetic information in a cell is copied. It's stored in this molecule, DNA, and then it's copied into RNA molecule, and then from there it serves as template to make the proteins, which are the building blocks of everything that we do and that we are, and you know, in terms of our organism. And a retrovirus does the opposite. So this was called the fundamental dogma of biology, where DNA is copied into RNA, which is made into proteins, and then that those proteins have functions.
But functions like building a nose or a leaf,
yeah, like
or whatever.
Building a nose or like crying or like making little molecules that will kill cells,
right,
or, you know, building muscle, etc., neurons in our brain.
So DNA goes to RNA, RNA builds proteins, proteins do things.
Yes,
okay,
exactly. But in the retrovirus, the RNA that originally stores the genetic information is copied into DNA. So it is an inverse process. It's the retro step of what is normal. So that's why it's called the retrovirus.
And that was a big discovery, because it went against what seemed like the normal pattern.
Yes, it was a big discovery. It went against what seemed the normal pattern. And also, this means that these viruses have to have very specific enzymes that transcribe this RNA in the reverse direction of what is used. And so enzymes that we don't have, because we again, plants, animals, everything that's based on DNA doesn't need to. And those are actually being used in molecular biology. Now that's been harnessed, the power of the discovery of those called reverse transcriptase, because they're an enzyme that does a reverse transcription, for us to study all kinds of things, not just retrovirus.
So HIV is a retrovirus.
Yes.
And so how does it behave differently from other viruses when it goes into the human body?
Well, in some ways, actually, it doesn't behave differently than other viruses. It just has to do what the other viruses have to do, which is copy itself over and over and over and over again. What is more specific of retrovirus, that often they can, and HIV does this, when it copies this RNA into DNA, then the DNA can be integrated in the cell's genetic material. And now this cell is infected, but the only difference between this infected cell and an uninfected cell, if it's not producing virus — if it's producing virus, then the difference is obvious, but if it's not producing virus, then the only difference is that there's a little bit of extra material in the whole genetic material that composes the genetic information of a, say, human being. There's this little bit of extra material that actually is the information to make virus. And it's almost impossible, to not to say really impossible at the moment, to distinguish a cell that has that in its genetic material from a cell that's just healthy.
So the little mechanisms that you described that go around,
right,
saying, is there anything wrong with this cell, don't detect,
yes,
there's an intruder sitting in the DNA,
right,
of your,
right,
cell. What kind of cells in the human body does HIV infect?
HIV infects mostly what's called CD4-positive T cells. And these T cells are also cells that are part of the white blood cells in our circulation. But they are fundamental in orchestrating, in controlling the immune response. They're also sometimes called T helper cells, because they typically would help those cells that I mentioned that kill infected cells. They would help those cells recognize that the cell is infected. They would help a B cell, those that produce antibodies that I talked before, get activated and start producing antibodies. So, you know, we could say that there is this cell that is very important in helping and controlling the immune response to virus and other things, not just virus, but bacteria, etc. And HIV goes directly and infects these cells. It also infects cells called macrophages, which are cells that are responsible to engulf other infected cells or debris of cells that have been killed and that need to be cleared, because after the cell falls apart, it has to be taken up, and macrophages do that. And so it infects these cells.
So it doesn't infect your liver cells or your heart cells or your brain cells. It infects your immune system response cells, that, as you just described.
Yes,
and
the vast majority of those cells are in immune response.
And so diseases that you would otherwise naturally fight off are much harder to fight off.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what happens. And in fact, in you know, strictly speaking, no one dies of HIV. HIV leads when it's to AIDS. AIDS is acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, and it's called a syndrome because really it's a collection of many different manifestations of this infection. And when the number of these T helper cells is too small, the immune system cannot fight off other infections, and people will show symptoms of other infections that usually we fight off, or we might even have these bugs inside us, but they're under control. And this will come up. For instance, TB, tuberculosis, it's a very important co-infection with HIV.
Or pneumonia,
or
Kaposi's sarcoma.
Yes.
Now, that's a question I have about, for example, Kaposi's sarcoma, which until AIDS became common was a very rare form of cancer. Does HIV directly cause the cancer, or does it just cause the immune system to fail to prevent the cancer?
Well, I think we think that HIV fails, it causes the immune system to fail to prevent that cancer.
But it's such a specific cancer. Why that one? Why do so many people with AIDS get that?
That's a very good question, but I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I'm sure it's known, but I don't know at the moment.
The thing about HIV is it's been very hard to make a vaccine. There are vaccines to other illnesses, to other viral illnesses. Why is HIV so hard to make a vaccination against?
Yes, vaccines have been very successful in many infections. Whereas in HIV, it's been quite difficult to develop one. However, I must say, you know, right from the beginning, that it usually takes many, many years to develop a vaccine for any infection, you know, decades often.
Right.
And HIV, in that sense, is still not longer than other than the what is normal to develop. However, there has been some, you know, the realization that HIV is a very difficult problem, even compared with other diseases. Why? There's several reasons, I think. One that's perhaps clear to see is that we don't know of any documented case where a person has cleared and has the natural immune response has cleared the virus and the person has cleared the infection and be healthy again.
Which is quite amazing.
It's quite amazing.
Because for most viruses, eventually somebody will recover.
Almost, I think. I cannot think of any other infection where a person either clears the virus or the immune system controls the virus to such low level that a person doesn't develop symptoms. You know, and whether you think of whether it's flu or hepatitis C or hepatitis B or smallpox or any of these things, Ebola virus, there's always some people that can fight off the infection. Even if they feel sick for a time, then they would recover.
Right.
And so this is I think, something that, and what is the implication of that? The implication of that is that then we don't know exactly what is a good immune response against HIV, because we have not seen one. Then there's other more, perhaps, you know, technical things, like HIV is very variable. Other viruses are as well. But HIV is extremely variable. That is, when it makes copies of itself, it mutates and makes small differences. And so, in those, when the immune system has to recognize on the surface of cells, here it's an infected cell, it always has to recognize something slightly different, because what's in the cell is, what's in the cells in general is changing over time.
So it's like there's an invading army, but they all wear different colored clothes and they're all different heights and they're carrying different things, and so you don't even know who's a foreigner.
Yes, and whatever they are carrying, you know, the clothes, the uniforms are changing over time. And the immune system does mount a strong response and tries to fight off the virus, and that's why we think a lot, you know, most people are infected for many, many years before they develop disease.
Right.
But it's not sufficient to eliminate the virus. Another thing that's, you know, very it's also specific for HIV is that, as I mentioned, HIV can go and hide, let's say, into the genetic material, our own genetic material, and those cells can go what's called latent. That is, they don't replicate, they are just infected. But if a cell is not replicating the virus, it's almost impossible, even for the immune system, to recognize it's infected, so it will not clear it.
So it won't clear it, and then what happens?
Well, then those cells are like stealth. They are there, and they could always, even as soon as the pressure of the immune system or of treatment, for instance, the drug treatment is not present, those cells could reignite the infection. They could start again producing virus, mostly maybe by random event that would start it, and they will. There's other viruses that also make these latent cells, but in HIV this is a significant problem for vaccine.
So the treatments that do work, I mean, I have a couple of friends who've had HIV since the early 80s, and they are taking treatments that do actually keep them healthy. What are those treatments? How do they work?
So If we look at, we know a lot about how HIV infects a cell and what is its life cycle inside a cell, what it does to replicate. One thing that I mentioned is that HIV has to go from RNA to DNA through this enzyme that we don't have called reverse transcriptase, And so one of the types of treatments that we have blocks the effect of this enzyme, of this this mechanism that the virus has to for one of the steps of its life cycle. Then the other thing that it does is that when
and that's what's called antiretroviral drugs.
That's one of the antiretroviral drugs that we have for HIV. And there's other ways. That now there's many different classes of treatments for HIV. As we discussed before, the virus needs to attach to some receptors on the surface of the cell, right? And so we can try to block that. And there are some treatments that act on this basis. They block this interaction, try to block this interaction, so the virus does not even get into the cell. After the virus is formed, and before it's released from the infected cell, it has this, all its proteins are stitched together in a very long chain. But for the virus to be active, it needs to cut this very long chain into the active proteins. And so it has another enzyme called the protease, because it cuts proteins. And one type of treatment blocks the action of this enzyme. So typically you want to block steps on the viral life cycle that are hopefully very specific for the virus, so that you're not blocking normal functions of the organism. And with an assortment of these drugs, multiple types at the same time, you can help the immune system control the virus to very low levels.
But still, there is no vaccine.
Right.
Do you feel that, I mean, just from the work you do, do you think that we are close to getting a vaccine?
I think we have to be cautious to say that we are close. When HIV was first discovered, which this year is the 25th anniversary, in 1983, with the scientific community thought maybe they could get a vaccine very quickly. You know, within, some people even mentioned like 5 years or something like that. And clearly that was not possible. And at the moment, I think it's still difficult to say how long it's going to be. Like, it's not going to be in the next 5 years, I think. If for nothing else, because not only a vaccine that works has to be developed, but then has to go into clinical trials and so forth, which takes a long time, or several years, until the results can be analyzed and can be a decision can be made on that.
And one of the problems is that HIV doesn't affect laboratory rats or other small animals that you can use as
right.
for experiments.
Right. So yes, that's one of the issues, is how do you test a vaccine even before you want to do these clinical trials? How do you know if it works or doesn't work? And often you have small animals like rats or mice in the laboratory that have an infection which might be similar or analogous to the infection that you're studying in humans, and you could test in those animals before you do it. But for HIV, there's no such model system as mentioned. I must say, you know, I don't work directly on these. We don't do animal experiments, so work with this.
Right. Well, it's unfortunately time to go. Rui Ribeiro is a theoretical biologist. He works as a scientist with the Theoretical Biology and Biophysics Group at Los Alamos National Laboratories. And once again, he will be speaking about HIV vaccines tonight at 7 o'clock at Santa Fe Complex. And they are at 624 Agua Fria Street here in Santa Fe. The number over there is 216-7562, and you can also see them at sfcomplex.org. Thank you so much, Rui, for being here with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the site santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.